Go ahead with the recording.
Thank you very much, Ricardo. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. This is the IRCPC call on the 7th of August, 2012. On the call today, we have Mikey O'Connor, Kevin Erdman, James Bodell, Barbara Knight, Michaela Malin, Hager DeFalla, Simona Tebataiga, Roy Dykes, Bill Cohen, Matt Serlin, Rob Golding, and Angie Graves. We have apologies from Paul Diaz, Bob Mountain, Avi Doria, Chris Chapler, and Jonathan Tenenbaum. From staff, we have Glenn de Saint-Géry, Barry Cobb, and myself, Natalie Peregrin. I would like to remind all participants to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you.
Thank you very much, Natalie, and welcome everyone to another exciting edition of the IRTPC Working Group for August 7th, 2012. As per our standards operating procedure, can anyone who has any updates to their statements of interest please indicate this by raising your hand now? No takers, so thanks for that. And also, I would ask that anyone who has had a chance to review the proposed agenda that was circulated by Barry to the mailing list and is posted on the right-hand column of the Adobe chat room, if you have any additions or comments or edits to that agenda, please raise your hand now. Okay, thanks. We'll consider that agenda adopted, and we'll move forward, beginning with item number three, which is a continuation of the review of public comments received to date, both in the public comments forum and in the workshop in Prague. As Barry noted when sending the agenda, this is the first of three sessions that we've identified in our work plan to review these comments. So we are we have this session and two more. Barry, go ahead.
Thanks, James. This is Barry. I just wanted to state before we get started with or picking up where we left off, if we can kind of start at the beginning. We had a couple of action items from our previous session.
Okay, thanks, Barry. And that was actually one of my next questions here was if we could start off at circling back to page one and then just hit on the highlights and then any action items that we have. And then I believe, I don't have the ability to scroll, but I believe that we then later on pick up, looks like somewhere in the neighborhood of page eight for the continuation of the review. So can you start us off, Barry, on page one? What breadcrumbs or mile markers do we leave for ourselves to circle back to?
Okay, thank you. This is Barry. The first one was based off of ALAC's comment that they had submitted in, and the dialogue from the working group was basically to talk about creating a visual representation of the transfer processes. I don't know if the entire group has seen, Mikey just sent out a first draft of that visual representation, and I have it uploaded and ready to go in the Adobe Connect room if we wish to review it now, or we can save it for the very end just so that we can move through the comments. So it's really up to you how you want to move forward.
I think that I do want to thank Mikey for sending that, and I think Michele and someone else has commented on it as well. I think that if we can just keep pushing forward, we'll come back to that. But let's keep that active on the list if it's not already circulated there.
Okay, very good. The next action is on page 5, row number 10, and this was a comment from the registry stakeholder group. And basically, it was an action out to Roy Dykes to try to get some clarification on the comment from the registry stakeholder group. And basically, the comment is the registry group supports the third option, which permits the registrant to opt out of the 60-day restriction on IRTP after a change of registrant. It is the view of the registry stakeholder group that this option is outlined in the possible step 5 of the proposed change of registrant process on page 23 would be most effective if both the prior and new registrants are required to affirm their desire to opt out.
Okay, and if memory serves, I see Roy is on the call, so I'm going to probably put him on the spot here in a moment. But if memory serves, there was a bit of confusion about whether or not the both parties were known at that time. Or I'm sorry, maybe I'm misstating that. But there was, it seemed like there was a hole in the knowledge in that recommendation. Roy, did you have any thoughts or any updates from your group, your constituency?
This is Roy for the purposes of the recording, and apologize for my voice. I feel better than I sound. I think the key words that are missing here from the comment are the words change of control. So all this says is that if there's a change of control of the name, and both parties in both, you know, registrants in the change of control activity are agreeable, that they both may opt out and have the 60-day restriction window go away. That's it. Unless, and I think I've captured that correctly, unless Barbara, and I see her hand up now, has additional comments on it. But Barbara and I did talk about this offline to make sure that there was a way to present the view of the registry stakeholder group, and I'll let Barbara talk now.
Thanks, Roy. Barbara?
This is Barbara. So, I mean, yeah, exactly what Roy said. I think there's some confusion because it was our understanding, or at least our interpretation as the registry stakeholder group, that in this particular case, the change of control happens before, obviously, a change of registrar happens. So the registrar of record would have both the previous registrant information as well as the current registrant information. So we felt that they would have all of that information to be able to confirm with both the prior registrant as well as the current registrant that both would choose to waive the restriction, the 60-day restriction. And we felt it was important for the prior registrant to be able to offer their, you know, be required to provide their waiver as well, because it would act as a red flag to them to the extent that, you know, somebody did change the registrant information and then wanted to go ahead and transfer the domain name, and they weren't aware that the registrant information on that domain has changed. You know, by being required to opt out of that, it would basically raise a red flag to them that says, hey, something's happened to my domain name, and why am I being asked to opt out of, you know, a restriction on transferring it for 60 days? So we just thought it was a method by which to, I guess, have an additional registrant protection in there to give them that additional heads up.
Okay, thanks, Barbara. Simonetta, go ahead.
Sorry, I also lost my connection to Adobe Connect, so I can't take my hand down. But my comment would be that this assumption that the previous registrar always knows who the new registrant will be is just not, I don't think is realistic, because in most transfer scenarios where there's been a sale and the new owner is with a different registrar than the previous, where the seller had the name registered at, there's not usually any way to know for the losing registrar who the new registrant will be. So I don't know if that use case is even, does what happens in reality justice, is my comment, I guess.
Thanks, Simonetta. I have myself in the queue, but I wanted to take a swing at responding, just because I started off on this issue thinking similarly to Simonetta's, but I think I can get it now, which is that in the conjunction with obtaining approval for the change of control, since that requires approval of both parties, that there would be this other checkbox or whatever where the opt-out would be offered at that time. So it would only be this opt-out would only be gathered from both parties when the change of control was approved. At least that's my understanding. I may be misstating the registry's position on that, but that was kind of where I thought this was going. It looks like Barbara's agreeing, so it seems like I finally get it. It took me, I don't know, a couple of attempts on that. I have a question and a suggestion. So one is, and this is just speaking as a registrar who does have a practice in place like this, and we use terminology like lock and restriction and things like that, and I think that is doing a disservice to some extent. And I realize this is just semantics, and some of you might be rolling your eyes and saying I'm spinning this, but I do believe that calling this some sort of a hijack protection is important, especially when we talk about allowing people to opt out of this service. I think that it might, when we get to the point in the report where we're saying what we want to allow people to opt out of, I think it's important that we, both the new registrant and particularly the old registrant, realize that they are opting out of a hijack protection mechanism. There's probably a less clumsy way to say that. But I think that would convey the message that, this is something that is done not to hassle people, but to make sure that you, are not being, becoming a victim of a hijacking. And I think most folks who are approving a change of control will immediately recognize that this is legitimate and that this is something that they want to do, and that those protections are not necessary to their situation, and they'll just gladly opt out of it. But it might be just it might give pause to those folks who might be affected by hijackers. So that was just my thought here, not really any action item or anything that needs to be captured in this document, but just more of a terminology discussion. So I guess I see that the queue is clear. I wanted to say thank you to Roy and Barbara for clarifying that statement, and I think that makes sense. Can we then take a look at the next one, Barry? Was that part of the same... No, that's me. Okay, so can you read through the part that I forgot to do?
Before we move on, so I think we've made the clarification with respect to row 10. Is there any kind of recommended action that we should document now, or is this something that the working group will circle back on in later deliberations?
I think that we need to decide whether or not to adopt this now that it makes sense. Before, I think it wasn't making sense, but I think now that it's been clarified, we just need to mark this as an open question of should both parties be allowed to opt out of the 60-day transfer restriction. And I think that dovetails with the other question of should there be a 60-day transfer restriction, and then that follows on to that they should be allowed to opt out of it. That's my takeaway. Anyone else? I see that the queue is empty, but if anyone else has a different read on this, please let me know. Yeah, Rob Golding, I think, points out that obviously hijackers are going to opt out. I think that's a good point, Rob. At least, one side of the transaction at least has an opportunity, which is not perfect. But, we can assume that the bad guys are always going to opt out. Michele, go ahead.
Well, obviously I agree with what Rob's saying. And adding to that as well, I have a general... What's the word I'm looking for? I generally don't like policies where there's too many opt-outs. I mean, either the policy is binding on everyone or it doesn't exist. Because, I mean, surely what we're driving for is uniformity of policy and... what's that other word people like to use? Coming to me. Oh, yeah, predictability. Either we agree that, that there is a lock of some kind, or we agree that there shouldn't be a lock of some kind. But this opt-out thing I just see as being a massive can of worms, which is going to come back and bite everybody in the rear end. Thanks.
Thanks, Michele. I tend to agree. But let's mark that. I think what we're doing here with this comment, we're reviewing these things, we're getting clarification where we don't understand the comment, but we're also leaving ourselves markers because we're identifying existing and new open questions that I think have to be a part of our future deliberations before we get to a final report. And I think that what you've just mentioned is one of them. Rob, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm going to end up agreeing with Michele. I don't think there should be the option for people to opt out. I mean, as I typed into the chat, the bad guys are going to opt out, and hopefully the good guys, if they've sold the domain, are going to opt out. So there's no point having an option where the default is going to be that people are going to opt out. If we're going to implement a hold on transfers of a domain for however long, 60 days, after change of contacts, prevent hijacking, then there should be a rule, not an option.
Okay, thanks, Rob. I think that's a good point. Simonetta, you're up next.
I just wanted to add to that and say that the reason we put this opt-out scenario in there was to find a compromise between security and portability, and I think that if we're now looking at not doing this, then we're going to have a much larger conversation again around locks that don't currently exist.
Yeah, thank you, Simonetta. And I wanted to point out to everybody, it's probably not, well, I don't want to say appropriate, because if I can, everything's appropriate, but it's probably not the best use of our time to start this deliberation process here when we have so many other comments to go through. I think we have a good approach, which is to indicate that this is an issue that needs further discussion and that we're going to have those discussions before we get to a final report, but not necessary to maybe get into those deliberations at this time when we still have so many unreviewed comments. So if we could push forward here, I can give everyone the commitment that we're not going to finalize any decisions on this without a healthy and probably lengthy discussion. So with that, can we, Barry, can we move to number 11 and the homework
yes.
that I forgot to do?
Yes. So basically there were two actions here. Again, what James just mentioned about trying to understand internal process with GoDaddy. That the working group can leverage, and then the second one I think was also to Roy to get clarification from the registry stakeholder group comment as well.
Okay, and I will own up to the fact that I did not get that information, and I will do that here today, this week, so it's to the mailing list by this time tomorrow. But I think that what we're looking at, once again, is that we're talking about disputes between individuals listed versus organizations, and when an individual, like if it's the individual listed as the registrant is James Bladel, and then the organization is James Co., how do we reconcile that if someone from James Co. comes up and says, hey, you know, James left the company and we need to reassign this? Or, how does it work when James leaves James Co. and says he wants to take the domain with him and take the organization off that? I think where's that threshold? Where's that tipping point where this becomes a change of control? And I think that there's a lot of fuzzy logic involved. We have some procedures. I will go back and borrow or at least report back on those to the mailing list and get that back to this group for our consideration. And then the next item was the discussion a little bit about the, it looks like we're still talking about opting out of 60-day restriction on inter-registrar transfers. Roy, your name's attached to this one. Do you remember why?
No, I think you summarized it already. I think that's correct. There's the notion of, Hey, if James has left the company and somebody else, and John, for lack of a different name, is now the owner, and there's a transfer, why should there need to be a 60-day wait period for John to execute that activity? So, I think these last two fall in the same sort of bucket, right? And that's under the umbrella of, do we have this do we have this opt-out or not, right? To McKaylee's point and others, it's another opt-out, but it's actually a different opt-out because the circumstances are slightly different. So you start to have this basket of opt-outs, and I think it's more philosophical relative to where does the team want to go, where does the group want to go, what do we think is in the best interest of the community.
Okay, thanks, Roy. And I will once again just go back and make sure I get a pretty healthy and comprehensive explanation from our team, put that to the list, and then I would hope other registrars would also be forthcoming in sharing their procedures and how they treat the differences between individuals and organizations, especially or particularly when they are in dispute. Barbara is next in the queue. Go ahead, Barbara.
This is Barbara. So just to kind of, I guess, expand on what Roy was saying, I mean, this really does relate to that original opt-out requirement, so I don't really view it as an additional opt-out, but it's, you know, in the case where the domain name is registered to a company or an entity, and, again, the person who may be listed as the registrant or the admin contact who would be able to, you know, to do the opt-out is no longer there. So it's basically making certain that we've covered that particular scenario where it may not necessarily be just an individual domain name holder. It could very well be an entity, but, you know, as we know, people do change jobs or change organizations. So it's basically just having a mechanism in there to be able to have a workaround so that people aren't stuck with, you know, something for, I mean, I don't think 60 days is actually that long of a period of time, but, you know, that they're not stuck having to keep their name there in the event that there has been a change of personnel at a company. So it's just, you know, kind of taking into consideration that scenario.
Okay, thanks, Barbara. So it sounds like all of the burden of this is on my lap at this point, and I fully accept that. McKelly, go ahead.
Sorry, I put myself on mute by accident. I mean, in terms of differences from our perspective, I mean, I think I mentioned this previously. From our perspective, it's very, very simple. Either the services you have with us are for a private individual or they're for a legal entity, be that a company or business or some other kind of organization. That doesn't mean that we don't have disputes, but that's how we view it. I mean, whether the account on our end is set up as one or the other will define how we deal with any issues surrounding the domain name or any other service that they may have with us. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, McKaylee. Barry, can we just note here that I have a homework assignment to get something to the list here in short order, and then hopefully we won't have to circle back to this next week, because that will, you know, kind of kick off a discussion on this on the mailing list, and then we can identify this as one of our continued open questions.
Got it.
But I think it lives in my lap right now, and I need to get this addressed.
Very good.
Okay. What was the next item that was scheduled for?
I believe that takes care of any actions that we had identified last week. I will draw attention to row 13 that I think is where we ended our call last week, and there was a discussion about it, but we didn't walk away with any particular recommended action. And then basically row 14 is where we need to pick up from.
Okay, thanks, Barry. Can you walk us through comment number 14?
Sure. Okay, this is from the ALAC, and if you recall from the last session, their response to the public comment forum was three or four paragraphs, and I believe this was paragraph number 2 that was extracted that it looked like that it belonged to this section of the public comment tool. The ALAC similarly support all efforts to formally define the process by which the registrant of record can be changed with implicit safeguards to inhibit hijacking. The ALAC does not have strong views as to whether this needs to be a separate consensus policy or not, but the overall results and benefits to registrants should not be diminished by this decision.
Okay, thank you, Barry. I don't know that there's any specific takeaway or action from us on that comment. It looks like they are supporting a lot of what the working group is saying as a whole, is that we want this to be a formal process that has effective but not burdensome safeguards, and I think we're still open to the idea of whether this is a separate policy or not. Okay, well, any thoughts on that before we move on to item 15? Okay, Barry? Hello?
Sorry, I was on mute.
Okay.
Row 15 is from the public workshop in Prague. The commenter was not specifically identified. The more restrictions you have on a process like change of registrant, the fewer the uptake of CCPLD registries is in practice. The working group may also want to consider what the effect may be on the GPLD market space.
Okay, thank you, Barry. And I vaguely recall this line of discussion while we were in Prague. My takeaway was that this is a high-level description of our opportunities and concerns with consulting the CCNSO and surveying the CCPLD landscape to find out what practices are out there, which ones work, which ones don't work, and which ones would be compatible with the GTLDs and which ones would make a mess of things. I don't know that there's a specific takeaway in this comment except perhaps to reiterate the caution to this working group that just because something works in CCCLD does not mean it is immediately applicable to the GTLD space, particularly when you get into things like thin registries. So that would be my general reaction to this comment. Any others? The queue is clear. Barry, if you could take us to number 16.
Okay, number 16 was also from the workshop in Prague. It's difficult to distinguish between correcting spelling mistakes or ownership changes, ergo changing from James to Jim might be the same person, but it could also it could be also someone completely different.
Thanks, Barry. I also remember this one as well, probably because I think I used myself as an example in the workshop. This is another one of those fuzzy logic problems that we discussed. I think we also mentioned the case, the situation where someone, typically a woman, but it doesn't have to be, I guess, in Western cultures, would get married and want to change their name but not necessarily indicate to their registrar that the registrant has changed to a new person. There are individuals who change their names. There are individuals who correct typos or misspellings in their names. And at what point does that tip over into a change of registrant? I don't know that there is an exact answer here. I think that what we have done as a practice, and I'll just throw this on the table, is that we've offered individuals who believe that we've made the wrong call in this to let us know that, hey, you know, I went from James, but I am also Jim, and then they can indicate that, you know, in an email, and usually we will back down from any sort of anti-hijacking safeguards that we've enacted as a result of that if we feel that it in fact was not a change of control. It was just a correction or a name change for the same individual or entity. But that's something that we should bear in mind when detecting a change of control. Any other comments on this? I see some things going by in the chat, but no one's raising their hand in the queue. There we go. Simonetta, go ahead, please.
I think the only thing that I remember from the Prague thing about this comment was also that I believe it was also said that something about the frequency of these type of updates, and I'm wondering if we could actually somehow find out, maybe from GoDaddy or from Black Knight or from one of the other registrars in this chat, in this work group, how frequently these type updates actually happen. And if it turns out that this is a very frequent activity, then we should really think about what kind of confirmation steps and other things we would require people to go through with when they make simple changes like this, because I believe what the person said in the room, and I don't remember who it was that this is a very frequent occurrence of a change in registrant record, and that they don't wish to complicate this for the user.
Thanks, Simonetta, and I put myself in the queue just to respond real quickly. I will definitely go back and get some indication of how common this occurrence is and how we usually deal with it. I will point out that this is just another one of those, you can call it fuzzy logic, you can call it a judgment call. One of my challenges is, you know, if you can't express something in logic or in code, I think that makes it very difficult to express it in a policy. So, you know, it becomes problematic to say, here's the line between an update or correction to a name versus here's, you know, anything on the other side of that line suddenly becomes a change of control. I don't know that that line is always well-defined, particularly in cases where we're talking about different languages, different entity types, et cetera. So, but I will definitely go back. It's less of a line and more of a very wide gray area. So, but I will go back and get some idea of our process on this and share what I can. And I see McKelly is in the queue behind me. So go ahead, McKelly.
Well, I basically decide what most of our processes are, so I can probably answer most questions on what we do or don't do. Our way of dealing with things is to do everything in line with Irish law. I mean, being perfectly honest, and I think I know Rob will probably agree with me since we tend to agree on some of these things. Ultimately, we are going to be bound by Irish law first, European law second, and any ICANN policy third. I mean, that's the reality. We would deal with whether a change of contact is just for billing and nothing else, or a change of contact or a move around is for whatever. I mean, we will follow pretty much the same processes, whether they're just doing so for a hosting account or for a domain name or whatever. And of course, yeah, there are going to be areas where there's going to be issues, but that's reality. There's no way for you to possibly imagine every possible crazy scenario that can happen. I mean, we've had people drop dead. We've had people get divorced. We've had groups of people decide to do things together, and then they have a massive falling out, and they don't want to talk to each other. We're currently dealing with an issue where a company has three directors, and one director is obviously having a dispute with the other two. I mean, there's no way you can possibly write policy for all that. All you can do is decide on a sane policy, something which is compliant with local law, and apply it as best you can. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, McKelly, and I appreciate you. Your statement illustrates many of the challenging positions that registrars often find themselves in. And one of our common statements in situations like that is that we will not adjudicate or resolve those types of disputes. We will establish a registrant based on the documentation that we have. You know, I think that with the understanding that there is some weight given to the status quo, and that there are other processes such as UDRPs and court actions that are available to registrants who believe that we're not addressing those appropriately. But I don't know that that I'm hoping that that is a minor consideration, and this goes, I think, back to Simonetta's point, that the more common occurrence is these relatively benign name changes or updates that do not affect change of control, that fall short of that threshold. And so I'm hoping that we're able to at least put some structure around those, or at least define the boundaries of that gray area, and then understand that registrars have some discretion inside of their, based on their jurisdiction and their local laws and you know, their current practices. Simonetta, go ahead.
Well, I think this is exactly the point that this comment is trying to make, that it is impossible to define this in terms of policy of what is like a small, benign little change versus a true change of registrant, especially when you get into non-Latin scripts or you get into address information and other things that you can't even judge because they don't follow a standard pattern that you might be familiar with in the United States or in Europe, or with like names that you cannot distinguish as a Western person between this and that as James and Jim versus James and Monica in some kind of other script. And I think that was the point that this person was trying to make, is that you can't distinguish this, therefore think about whatever you do, it will also cover these type situations and don't make it too complicated.
Yeah, it's a good point. And if I could respond to that pretty quickly, I know you probably don't want us to linger on this for too much longer, but you know, I think that what we are talking about here, we're really just discussing three fields in the WHOIS. We're talking about registrant first name, registrant last name, and organization name. I don't think anyone is maintaining that address changes or email updates or fax number changes or whatever constitute anything approaching a change of control. So we're really just identifying that there are a few sensitive fields. Yes, I agree that, you know, that it's not clear in other scripts and other languages what is just a routine update versus a wholesale change. Wanted to mention one other item, but then we should probably, I see McKelly has his hand up, but so let's, you know, let's go to McKelly on this one, but I think we'll probably need to bring this one in for a landing. Go ahead, McKelly.
Sorry, James. I know we've kind of touched on this before, but I think for the purposes of showing the world that we're not totally insane, let's recognize something which is kind of key when it comes to managing, controlling online services in general, be they domain names, hosting, or any service you buy online. The email address is not a simple field. I mean, it'd be great if it was, but let's face it, it isn't. If I want to gain access to a lot of online services, the email address is going to be the lever. Most communications surrounding domain names are going to be via email with most registrars. I know there are a couple of exceptions, like Matt's registrar, for example. But we have to be conscious of the fact that an email address isn't just a simple change. I mean, it's not something that's going to kind of trigger a massive audit or anything like that, but just being overly dismissive of the importance of the email address in association with the domain name or the account and all that, I think is something quite dangerous. We should be very wary of doing that.
Understood, McKelly, and certainly wasn't trying to be dismissive, but I think that, you know, we're going to need to draw a boundary somewhere, and you know, I don't know if that's if email falls, which side of the line that falls into. And, you know, let's keep in mind, from my perspective, let's keep in mind that if we're discussing the absence of any kind of transfer restrictions or the ability to opt out, then what is the real impact to someone, let's say, who does this change? If I see a domain name that says Jim and I change it to James and they send me some approval form and I click the box and suddenly I'm both the new registrant and the old registrant, has it really inconvenienced me? all that much that the registrar made a mistake and thinks I'm two separate people. I don't know. You know, it's in practical terms, it's not really that big of a deal, and I can maybe appreciate that they were trying to be careful. The other side of this is that we need to be careful that we're not straying into what I call the identity problem. I think that, Michele, this is what you're touching on, is that there is currently no universal international language and jurisdiction neutral way of establishing and verifying identity on the internet, and that it's possible that some of the discussions and some of the comments that we will encounter in the work of this working group might stray into those waters, and we should just recognize that that solution currently doesn't, or that that area currently doesn't have a solution. So, you know, we need to make sure that whatever we're doing or whatever we're recommending is at least cognizant of that black hole. So, any other thoughts on this comment? Number 16, and as I said, I will include that in my report to the working group as I go back and get some practices from our team, and I hope that other registrars would respond to that thread. Okay, the queue is clear at this point. Let's move on to comment number 17, Barry, which starts to look a lot like comment 16, but I'll let you walk us through it.
Yes, indeed. This is also from the workshop in Prague. How are corporate changes affected by this policy, ergo changes from Inc. to LLC or changes as a result of merger acquisition? In terms of the working group response, I was really just going to refer this back to row number 11, which was from a registry stakeholder group comment, and then how any actions that may come out of that would occur on row 11.
Okay, thanks, Barry. And I see it as, attached to row 11. I see it as attached to row, the one immediately preceding this as well. It's kind of a corporate or a legal entity equivalent of correcting a name or, changing a legal designation without actually changing an entity. And then, of course, we can also say that mergers and acquisitions are the corporate equivalent of marriages, et cetera. So I think it all kind of blends together, whether we're talking about natural persons or legal persons. So any further thoughts on this one? Anyone see any special case for comment 17 that we should be aware of? Okay, let's move on to comment number 18, which I think reopens our discussion of fields. Barry, if you would walk us through that, please.
Yes, this is from the Prague workshop as well. When you change house or telephone number, you also need to provide proof of ownership, so it's not unreasonable to ask for a similar confirmation in the context of a change of registrant.
Okay, thank you, Barry. I'm not really clear on this comment, and then we may need to go back to the transcript and tease out some more context, but when they're saying when you change house or telephone number in the Whois data or in the real world, you need to provide proof of ownership. I don't know. Can anyone shed any light here? Michele, do you remember this one?
I'm not 100% sure what this specifically refers to, but I think the point is it comes back to something we have discussed at some point. I'm sure we have discussion about it. It was down to, I think it's, the key word is authorization. Again, if I wanted to update mnalem.com to put in your postal address, James, at the moment there's nothing to stop me from doing that. And actually, at a presentation that we were both at in Arizona, we had ICE talking about how some people will actually register trademark infringing domain names using pretty much all the contact details of the trademark of the brand holder they're infringing, except maybe for the email address. I think that might be what they're referring to. I honestly don't know. But that was what I suspect is they're talking about.
Yeah, and I think maybe this, I may have to punt over to Barry to help us provide some context here. I think that, you know, if this comment is essentially just saying that, you know, it's not unreasonable to ask someone to confirm or approve a change of registrant data, I think we can say, yes, thank you, we agree, and, you know, thank you for your support. But if they're saying something different, if they're saying something along the lines of that registrants have to approve changes to other fields that may fall short of the threshold of a change of control, then I think that's a different topic altogether. So I think we need some more context on this, and Barry, can you maybe put a marker here for next week to give us an idea of what was said before and after this comment so that we can bookend it with some background?
Will do.
Okay, thanks. Okay, so let's move on then to comment number 19.
This is also from Prague. If a domain name registration account is compromised, the hijacker can easily opt out of any restrictions that the working group may put into place.
Okay, thank you. And I think that this is part of what we were discussing with the opt-out with the registry comment, and I believe Mr. Golding also mentioned this as well, is that hijackers are always going to opt out of any type of protection mechanisms. Okay, any other thoughts on that? We can move on to comment number 20. Barry?
20 is also from Prague. The working group may need to consider an exception process for certain circumstances, such as, for example, UDRP, where the standard process of transferring a domain name after a UDRP is changing the owner name, and then it is transferred out.
And this is a good comment, I think, that where we were discussing the impact of establishing a change of control with any kind of protections against hijacking. I think that another avenue would be that whatever mechanism, recommendation, or new policy comes out of this working group, that it is immediately referred to the UDRP as one of the means by which registrars can implement decisions coming out of the UDRP panel. I think that it's worth considering that if there is any sort of restriction, that it would have an override mechanism by UDRP. I don't think that that's necessarily controversial, but I think that the question is, you know, can we get other registrars to use the change of control mechanism coming from this working group instead of, or in place of, or in addition to what UDRP decisions are currently being used to implement. So any thoughts on this one, folks? I know we're starting to run up against the last few minutes of our call, but I don't think that's controversial at all. Okay, comment number 21.
Yes, this is Barry. We basically have two comments, and we'll close out, for the most part, the recommendation one section. So hopefully we can get to them. I think Michele has his hand raised.
Michele, is this for number 20 or number 21?
It's for number 20, I agree. For number 21, I have issues with this, as I would have with a lot of anything making certain things mandatory for registrars.
Okay, can we have Barry read through that first, and then you'll start us off on that discussion?
Sure.
Okay, Barry, go ahead.
This is from Prague. Why not make mandatory for registrars to offer one or more optional ways of locking a domain name against transfers after element changes, like GoDaddy has been doing it, and other registries are doing it by introducing manual processes or different ways of protecting their customers in a way that the registrar must give their registrant an option to lock a domain name, but the registrant, if he does not choose to go for the that the option domain can be transferred quickly.
I'm going to guess this was a copy-paste from the transcript because it does read a little rough, and I don't really understand how someone can make optional ways mandatory. Anyway, Michele, go ahead. Help us here.
I'll try. It is one, as Mikey put in the chat, it's one heck of a sentence. Okay, first off, I think part of what this person is asking about is that registrars should offer more protections to registrants, and my answer to that would be, surely that's what this working group is discussing, and we thank them for their input. But making it mandatory and also making it optional is rather confusing, because as you said, I don't see how you can make something mandatory and optional at the same time. That doesn't work for me. I'm actually going to step away from this now, because actually, as I read that comment, it's so that the sentence is so convoluted, I'm running to the hills screaming, asking for commas.
Thanks, Michele, and I'm actually putting myself in the queue, but I'm going to take my hand down too and say that the more I read it, the less certain I think I'm understanding the intention. So go ahead, Simonetta, it's all yours.
Well, I'm not sure if that was the intent of the comment, but it could be read such that if you turn this locking idea around and you say it's not the default that everything is locked, but the default is that everything is open, but you give registrants a choice to lock things down more securely. And I'm thinking about what some of the corporate registrars are already offering to their customers, where you can buy extra protection, and then that basically means that you can't just unlock the name in the user interface. You have to call and on the phone provide some extra password or something else to unlock the name. That if you do it this way around, you have the opportunity to give a registrant the choice to make their name more secure while leaving it open for everyone else to move names around without locking restrictions and things like that. So that's an idea, and I think it's actually a neat idea, and we should explore this as well.
Okay, thanks, Simonetta. And I can point out that our registrar offers a number of services that do this, and they're fairly popular. However, they're not 100% uptake, and therefore there's always going to be those vulnerabilities. Also, IRTPB, the previous instance of this series of working groups, has some new recommendations/restrictions on the locks that registrars can implement and how they have to remove them upon the request of the registrant and things like that. So I think it's could be debatable whether or not those new policy requirements will have an impact on those security products. Unfortunately, it looks like we are one comment shy from closing off this section, but we have run out of time. I know that Simonetta is noting she has to drop off at the top of the hour. I do as well, and I think I'm probably not alone in that. So let's put a marker here. And I think we have a couple of people, well, let's be honest, it's me, that have some homework to do and owe some responses back to the working group, so I will get started on that right away. And thank everyone for their time, and we will see you next week.
Thanks, James.
Thank you, James.
Bye, James.
Thank you very much, Ricardo. You may now stop the recording.